Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hey, and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. We are coming to you live from our studio here in downtown, the metro area of Rural Retreat, Virginia. And we're very excited to have you aboard. We've finally gotten around to putting together our next podcast here, and so we're ready to roll. We want to look at, for starters, we're going to... Oh, and I'm the patriarch. I have to think about that. I almost always want to say progeny, but you're the progeny.
I'm the progeny, and our other host is the professor.
And the paterfamilia.
Yes, now we have the paterfamilias.
And I don't have any Whoppers this week, so I'm having to substitute lemon drops. But we're going to look at our comments from last week. And once more, we really thank Daryl for the comment, talking about the New York Times setting the journalistic standard, if you will, before Drudge came along. And I doubt that not. I mean, I still recognize the influence that the New York Times has over that group. I mean, it's we ought to talk about that sometime, is that the journalism in America, how that machinery operates, because, you know, now we've got this incestuous relationship between corporations and journalists and, you know, big business and media, not just people that are supposed to be telling us what the news is, but people that are entertaining us as well. So that's a topic for another day, but we thank you for Daryl for the comment, and I think it's a point well taken, is that, you know, but I also think that I haven't studied this, but my feeling is the New York Times influence has diminished and continues to diminish as the internet, you know, continues to...
What do you think is the most...
Until net neutrality comes along.
What do you think is the most influential source of news today?
Well, you mean the most influential news reporting entity?
Yeah, well...
Probably, I would guess it maybe very well could be the New York Times still. Or Drudge. I mean, I think Drudge is truly amazing, the effect that Drudge has on that community. I really do.
What about
I remember hearing once that, you know, somebody was walking through a newsroom and they glanced over and Drudge was on, you know, several people's monitors as they walked by.
What about the network news, like the establishment? Do you think it's quickly becoming kind of just...
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know who watches it anymore. I have not watched it in years and years and years. And I used to watch it religiously.
I mean, frankly, my generation, you know, the most influential place you can go is BuzzFeed, which is where Obama went. You know, at least he recognizes that. But
I've never been on their site. They don't know. Maybe I have.
Oh, you have. You have. Everybody's been on it sometime or other. They post lots and lots of GIFs and funny sayings and stupid stuff.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like my kind of place. Highbrow.
Yeah, I joined Tumblr this week. I've joined Tumblr as... I've got a blog now on there. It's Longish Thoughts. And I think that the entire Tumblr universe is populated of teenage girls about the age 14 or 15. And all of them love Benedict Cumberbatch. That's kind of my idea of Tumblr. So, anyway.
I am a Swiftie now, so.
Yeah, yep. The patriarch has...
Drunk the Kool-Aid.
Yes.
I'd like to announce my candidacy for President of the United States, and I am a Swiftie too. So.
Yes, he likes Taylor Swift. As his new biography over at the Pilgrims Podcast page will attest, I told him he needed to update that page, but since he didn't, then somebody else did.
I've been slandered.
An anonymous source.
Slandered, and...
Well, you know what you need to do. You need to shake it off. Taylor Swift humor. Okay, well, we probably better get on topic, which will be interesting because we have a variety of information about Charles Dickens today that we're going to be talking about, and I happen to know quite a bit about Dickens because I wrote a paper about him in, I think, the senior year of high school, and I read a biography of him by G.K. Chesterton. I reread that book for this podcast. It's an excellent biography, though it's kind of a typical Chesterton book in which he tends to just ramble on at length about whatever things happen to pop into his mind. So he was convinced that Charles Dickens was the greatest Democrat of the 19th century, pretty much, in that he just was for the common people. And so he would spend just reams and reams of paper talking about Charles Dickens and the common people and revolution and radicalism. And it's just like nothing to do with Dickens, it feels like. I mean, sort of, but mostly Chesterton being Chesterton. It's a fun book because, and I mentioned it just kind of as an interesting point of trivia, Chesterton wrote it in 1908, I believe. At that point, nobody was reading Dickens anymore.
When did Mr. Dickens live?
He was born in 1812. He died in 1870. When Chesterton wrote his biography, nobody was reading Charles Dickens because they had consigned him to the rubbish heap and said, this guy is not, we're not interested in him anymore. He's vulgar. He talks about poor people way too much. He's too optimistic. He's too sentimental. All those sorts of things. But Chesterton came along with this biography, and it was extremely popular, and it pretty much spawned a Dickens revival, and we're still reading him today. It's never stopped since that point. So we may be able to credit Mr. Chesterton with giving us, with at least making sure that you read A Tale of Two Cities senior year. So there are probably a lot of people that would hate Chesterton for that. But
there's a lot of people that don't read A Tale of Two Cities every senior year.
Yeah. Everybody thinks they've read A Tale of Two Cities, but nobody has.
Nope.
We'll be talking about that one later. But I wanted to start out with kind of Dickens' early years, and I want to kind of talk about some of his biography. He was born on February the 7th in 1812 to a clerk named John Dickens. And he had a pretty happy childhood up until the point when his father went bankrupt. And he didn't know until the point his father went bankrupt that there were any money troubles at all. It was always kind of vaguely talked about, but never talked about directly. And you can kind of see, and so his father ended up losing his job and going to debtor's prison, which was the Marshalsea debtor's prison, which you can find in Little Dorrit, one of Dickens' later novels. In fact, all throughout his life, Dickens took many of the things that had actually happened to him and put them in his novels. There are all sorts of things, just extraordinary things that happened to him that were in those novels. He talks about in David Copperfield, his father on one day was writing up a paper to send to Parliament to explain why these certain prisoners should be let go. And there were a bunch of men that were coming in to sign this paper, and it was all very grand, and his father was making a speech. And he took that scene and put it in David Copperfield when the character Mr. Micawber is giving a grand speech in prison, talking about, you know, how Parliament should sort things out. Another thing that happened to Dickens, which is also in David Copperfield, because in Copperfield, little boy Davy ends up kind of having a surrogate family through the Micawbers. And when the Micawbers fall into debt, Davy has to go out and pawn things, which is what Dickens had to do when he was young. Dickens also had to go out and work in a blacking factory, much like Davy had to work at a counting house. And they were both quite miserable. There's a little anecdote that Chesterton tells, which I recounted to you last night, and I'll tell again, which I particularly enjoyed. Dickens worked alongside a boy who he really didn't like. This boy was always making fun of him because he saw Dickens as being a gentleman. He made fun of that. And he just really didn't like him. But one day, Charles, you know, he fell ill because he was a very weak child. He fell ill, and this boy took care of him. And, by the way, the boy's name was Bob Fagin. And this boy took care of him, and this boy insisted on walking him home once he had recovered. And Dickens, you know, suddenly had this huge problem on his hands because he was very proud. And this little boy, he did not want him to know that he lived at the debtor's prison. So he had a problem on his hands. So he took him through the streets, and this little boy was determined to do his duty by him, and Dickens was determined not to let him know. And eventually Dickens rushes up onto a house and knocks on the door and rings the doorbell, and Bob Fagin leaves, and somebody opens the door, and Dickens says, "Excuse me, does Mr. Robert Fagin live here?" And they said no, and so he said, "Well, thank you very much," and turns around and goes home to the Marshalsea, which kind of illustrates quite a few things. Number one, how he would often take little elements of his life and change them into his stories, that he would take names. I don't know how much the character of Fagin and Oliver Twist is based on Bob Fagin, or if it is at all, but that is there. And it also shows his gift for creation and for improvisation and for kind of a little bit of stage drama. As a child, he was also well known for always being a performer, for loving to perform. He was the little child they would bring into the room, and he would act out some sort of little play, and everybody would love him, and he would love himself. And he was always a performer, and that would carry on into his later life when he would give book tours, and he would read parts of his books. He would do one of the stranglings in one of his books, one of the famous stranglings, and he would play both the strangler and the stranglee. And he had a great deal of fun with it, and everybody else did too. Eventually, his father decided that he needed to take Dickens out of the blacking factory and send him to school. And Dickens' mother opposed that, which was something for which Dickens never forgave her. His father was really a piece of work, and his mother apparently was of much better character than his father, but Dickens never forgave his mother for doing that, for not wanting him to leave, because it was something that really scarred him for life, and that you can see kind of in all of his stories of children that are lost and alone and working in hard places. You can see echoes of that. He never told anybody about it except once his best friend, who found out by accident, and he kind of took him aside and told him the whole story. And you know, it was something that he obviously just kind of kept locked away. He didn't like to talk about it at all. After that point, though, he did go to school. He went to a boarding school where he felt like he'd kind of had more experience than all the other boys in the school. He didn't exactly know how to relate to them. But he left school. He became a clerk, I think, at a law office, where he found a bunch of very very arrogant lawyers who mostly sat around all day and did nothing. Is this starting to sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, and one of the things you notice about Dickens is how many lawyers he has in his books and how very few of them are ever serious characters. I mean, you got Mr. Guppy, you got Stryver and Carton, you've got Mortimer Lightwood and Eugene Rayburn, you've got Jaggers in Great Expectations, and you know, all of them are either crooks or lazy. So Dickens's view of lawyers was not very high. He used to sit in his room writing things and throwing cherry pits out the window onto the heads of passersby. He was so bored. Eventually, he taught himself to write shorthand, and he became one of the best shorthand writers on the circuit. He would go around. He was a journalist. He became a journalist after that. He ended up publishing his first stories, which were under a pseudonym, Boz, and they were called Sketches by Boz. in which he would take a character and kind of do a really eccentric character and do it in a little short story. And there were a bunch of them, and they were mildly popular, you know, kind of. But the real thing that brought his popularity was The Pickwick Papers, which was his first novel. And The Pickwick Papers is a book. It's about a fella named Mr. Pickwick, who's a member of a traveling club, I believe, and who travels all over England having a number of jolly adventures alongside his trusty sidekick, Sam. Sam Weller, who was the template for Samwise Gamgee, and that was The Pickwick Papers, and they were enormously popular. Just everybody loved them. They were not quite like anything anybody had ever seen before. They had that trademark Dickens exaggeration and extravagance, and nobody had seen anything this wild before. Nobody'd seen it. And so they weren't quite sure how to deal with it, but the common people just embraced it. They just loved it. Because I think, and I wanted to kind of talk about some of those really typical Dickens things that you can see in his first book. And I also wanted to talk about why people, even now, tend to kind of see him as a vulgar writer, as somebody who's, you know, very populist, very, very popular, but not really a serious writer. And Chesterton mentions exaggeration. I mean, a lot of people today don't like exaggeration in books. Would you agree?
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that. But okay. that they don't like exaggeration.
Yeah, I mean,
books?
Compared to realism. I mean,
I don't know about that. I mean, I think that the culture has been so kind of flooded with fantastical stories. I mean, you think about, I don't know, you know, War of the Worlds or something, which I know is not a book, but people are really gullible now. They'll believe just about anything, and so I don't know if I'm following you exactly, but for to me, exaggeration, yeah, I think people love exaggeration.
Yeah, I think people love exaggeration, but I don't mean people. I don't mean human beings. I mean literary critics.
Oh, no, probably not. I mean, you know, yeah, go ahead.
These people, they especially among serious writers, they've kind of elevated realism, which to them means something really gritty and really, really dry. And, you know, think P.D. James, for instance. They think that that's really, really artistic. And that's why they don't like Dickens.
Stephen King, you know, right?
Yeah, I mean they would have less problem with him.
He's, extremely popular, but I don't think he's ever going to win a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
Right? So.
Well, I think that Chesterton, for instance, he talked about it, but he said, look, he says, these literary critics, when they talk about realism, they talk about a world... creating a book in which the world is just really dark and gritty and gray, you know, that's their definition of realism. You know, oh, it's realistic. This is real, you know. But that's because they're actually exaggerating the darkness in the world. And Dickens exaggerates the wrong thing. We only like things we care about being exaggerated. They permit any writer to emphasize doubts, for instance, for doubts are their religion, but they permit no man to emphasize dogmas. If a man be the mildest Christian, they smell cant, but if he be a raving windmill of pessimism, they call it temperament. If a moralist paints a wild picture of immorality, they doubt its truth. They say that devils are not so black as they are painted. But if a pessimist paints a wild picture of melancholy, they accept the whole horrible psychology, and they never ask if devils are as blue as they are painted. So they're saying things along the lines of, like Richard Dawkins is always going on about how the God of the Old Testament is the worst thing in literature, and I'm like, have you read the Old Testament, dude? I mean, people exaggerate the wrong things. You're allowed to exaggerate certain things in books now. They don't like that Dickens exaggerates hope or, you know, or joy or the kind of the commonality of man, you know, all the brotherhood and, you know, everybody out having a drink and, you know, it's... Dickens is a very happy novelist. People don't like that very much anymore.
No, and I mean, I'm just now, I mean, I am far from any kind of a Dickens expert because I've really watched more than I've read. I'm reading through David Copperfield right now, and it has struck me as how funny it is in places and how almost whimsical it is, because he can, you know, it's definitely got its dark points, and I'm about halfway through, almost halfway through, I guess, and it's definitely got its foreboding and dark characters and oppression but then you've got characters that, like the Micawbers, and that are so whimsical that they pull you out of that, you know, and they are bigger than life in a lot of ways, I think.
Chesterton often described Dickens' stories as fairy tales, which I think is a good way of describing them.
I think you're exactly right.
And that's another thing that modern writers, and that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that they really despise fairy tales because they see them as unrealistic. They say, well, happy endings, you know, you're just looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. Yeah. But as Indy Wilson is fond of saying, well, you know, there are thunderstorms in the world. You know, there are lots of thunderstorms, and there's lots of death. There's lots of kittens, too. And there's lots of life. And there's lots of really sappy, sentimental things. Life is sentimental. There's all sorts of happy things in the world. And to be realistic, you have to talk about both of those things.
Well, we'd have to ask the professor about that. But
I'm sure he'll have something to say.
Well, the professor does have something to say about it. I remember him saying that that joy is the serious business of heaven, didn't you, Professor?
Indeed.
Yes, and so, you know, that if joy is the serious business of heaven, then joy is the serious business of us now, of Christians now. So it would behoove us all to bear that in mind, and that, I mean, I don't, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, it could be much worse, you know, and that's absolutely true. But even if it is much worse, or even if it's much better, I don't think we should let lose our focus on joy. And I think a lot of joy kind of is permeated through some of Mr. Dickens' writing.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you're right. But I want to define what joy is, because it's something I've been thinking about quite a bit recently.
Me too.
Joy is not happiness.
No, absolutely not.
And joy is not sadness. Joy is where happiness and sadness meet. Joy is almost like a kind of sorrow. I mean, the professor talks about this all the time, is that because joy, you can be enjoying something, but you always have to lose that something. And joy is not having something. Joy is longing for something. Joy is a verb. You don't have joy, you want joy. He spends a whole book, Surprised by Joy, talking about this, is that joy is like homesickness. It's something that's kind of oddly comforting, but there's always sorrow. Yes. It's always tinged with sorrow. I think he talks about Sehnsucht. I don't know how to pronounce that. It's German, but he talks about that. Well,
I'll pick on the matriarch for a moment. Is that, you know, she thinks that if she puts down a big meal in front of me, that will make me happy, and it certainly will make me happy. But it gives me joy when she sits down with me to eat. And so, you know, it doesn't really, I don't care so much about what I'm eating. It's who I'm eating with, you know, in that regard. So maybe that's oversimplistic, but is that a tear in your eye, Hannah? I think, yes, she's been touched by my cutting.
Yes, this is me. Can you hear the quaver in my voice?
Yes. Yeah, I'm that kind of guy.
But Dickens understood joy, because his stories are often very dark, but very funny. But the darkness in his stories is never really despair. His darkness, there's something about Dickens' darkness which is different from modern darkness. If you read a book that's set in kind of gritty Chicago with an existential, you know, some sort of neo-existentialist protagonist who's questioning whether he even exists, and you know, who thinks that morality is an illusion, then that's not, you know, kind of a horror. That's terror. That's like a terrifying thing.
Yes.
It's existential darkness.
It's real. I mean, it's real in that, you know, the pickpockets of the world and there are definitely some bad people out there. But I don't want to say that they're almost comic. We were talking about that earlier tonight. Is Silas Wegg and our mutual friend, and he was kind of in the dramatization. He's kind of somebody that's a little more
menacing,
yeah, but not really. I mean, he's got a wooden leg. You know, how threatening can he be?
Yeah, Dickens's villains are kind of splendid. It's like I keep on coming back to Chesterton, but this is what I've been doing all week. So he talks about how Dickens' villains feel like something that you would read about in the Hardy Boys or something when you're a kid, because it's somebody that kind of gives you a shock or a thrill of
Frank and Joe.
You know, yeah, well, it's like a, you know, he creates these kind of villains that you enjoy being scared of, but that you're not terrified of. These aren't serial killers. These aren't, or if they are, then they're kind of charming serial killers or something.
The Twist guy wasn't like that, was he? I haven't read that.
Bill Sykes?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was kind of more menacing, and that's kind of, but at the same time, Oliver Twist is, there is an element of adventure to it. There's kind of a horror, and Dickens is full of grave robbers and Tom Sawyer stuff. You know, it's villains that little boys love. And then Dickens, if there was anything that you could know about Dickens, it was that he had a little boy's heart when it came to just about everything. All of his romances were innocent, and all of his villains were painted as black as possible, and everything was very, very black and white. At least in the earlier novels, it became more complex as it went on. But
yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm halfway through David Copperfield, and Uriah Heep has been making some appearances, and I'm trying to figure him out a little bit. So I'm curious to see how that turns out.
Yeah, well, to get back on the topic of Dickens's biography, it was at this point that he published the Pickwick Papers, which catapulted him into stardom, and he got married about the same time. He next published Oliver Twist, which was as dark as the Pickwick Papers was lighthearted. And he also had a lot of social commentary in that one. There's lots of stuff, you know, about workhouses, about orphanages. There's a character who's a prostitute. There's a character who, you know, it's a very dark story. And all of those things, and that kind of showed Dickens' other side, which was his reformer side. And he really did manage to have an enormous influence throughout his lifetime reforming institutions. He would paint this huge, hilarious, terrifying satire of a boarding school, and it would be kind of a, it's Mr. Creakle sounds like somebody who, you know, he's the villainous headmaster. He sounds like somebody who would be terrifying to live with if he was real, but as it is, you kind of want to meet him because he's just such a marvelous Dickens character. But at the same time, Dickens, when he created these characters and he threw them out into the world, what ultimately happened was, because of his influence, the Mr. Creakles of this world ended up losing their jobs. There were people that were losing jobs because of Dickens. He would satirize somebody, and he would swear up and down that he wasn't basing it on this person, and they would still lose their job. The Circumlocution Office in Bleak House, all these things, he killed the Circumlocution Office because he made fun of it. And that was really what killed it. People could talk about how terrible it was all day, but it took Dickens making fun of it to end it for good. And so, yeah, he ended up doing that. And it was a really remarkable influence that he had throughout all of levels of society, because he united people as well with his stories. After Oliver Twist came a few other novels, kind of his lighter novels, Nicholas Nickleby, so on.
Can you say, tell me about a story about something about, as chapters would come out, people would read them aloud, or?
Yeah. He was somebody whose popularity is almost unimaginable now. He puts Benedict Cumberbatch into shame, and Benedict Cumberbatch sounds like somebody who could have come from a Dickens story. There would be like, you know, a group of 20 or so poor people who would get together every week and pool their money and buy the latest installment of the Pickwick Papers. And then they would all go out and crowd together, and whoever could read and whoever had the best reading voice would get up on a crate or something and perform the Pickwick Papers. And they would get to find out what happened to Mr. Pickwick as the week had gone, because they came out in serial magazines. They were the equivalent of soap operas. This was something that everybody was talking about, and it was just a national phenomenon. There was the novel The Old Curiosity Shop, which was also one of Dickens's earlier books, and there's a famous character called Little Nell, who's the beautiful, innocent female character in the story, who, you know, it's a Dickens woman, one of those women. And there were people coming over to America, I think it was from America, from England. You know, there was a ship coming in, a bunch of sailors, and people on the piers were waiting for the ship to come in, and they were yelling, "Is Little Nell okay?" Because last week it ended out in a cliffhanger, and they weren't sure what had happened yet, and and so people in America were on tenterhooks. It was a national phenomenon. People didn't know what to deal with it, and of course the upper classes is naturally were kind of thinking, okay, this guy, he's a man of the people, we look down on this person, but the poor people, they loved him. He loved them too. He loved his popularity. If there was one thing that Dickens never doubted, was that it was that Charles Dickens was a fine fellow, and he was always defending his honor. But to kind of look at similarities between then and now, can you think of anybody who could be Dickens's successor, just on that level of being able to appeal to all people?
Well, you mentioned earlier Mark Twain, and I don't know. I mean, that comes to mind. And oddly enough, maybe not. One of my favorite childhood authors was James Herriot, and you know, he had these odd characters, and there were his books were always just a joy to read, because you know it. They too had their dark moments, but in general everything turned out okay, and it was a light at the end of the tunnel, and it was a brighter day ahead, and all those good things. And those are the two guys that come to mind, especially Harriet. I mean, I really admire what Harriet did from the storytelling side of things, and the colorful characters that he would create, from Siegfried and Tristan to all the farmers that he'd meet on his round. So, you know, maybe it's not a highbrow type of thing or a comparison, but and Harriet, I think, had a fair amount of influence in his day, you know, at least in Europe. What about you?
I would say P.G. Woodhouse. Not so much on influence, perhaps, though I think he has had a great deal of influence in Britain, and kind of maybe in some of the intelligentsia in America, I don't know. He was somebody who wrote very simple things, you know, very simple stories, but about unforgettable characters.
Yeah, Harriet did that too.
Just like Dickens, he could create these characters that you feel like are still continuing on. Chesterton once, you know, said that Dickens didn't his characters, he didn't always manage to make them real men, but he always managed to make them gods, because these were characters that were just kind of immortal, that would were above everybody else because they weren't bothered by the prospect of death or serious things. Mm-hmm. They were something that some sort of quality about them where they had this sort of innocence, like they were you know, Mr. Pickwick would stumble into a problem in his innocence and manage to solve it just because he was so innocent, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you can see that reflected in Chesterton's Father Brown. And I think you really have to kind of understand Chesterton's own belief about the power of a sort of innocent. To really understand Father Brown.
Well, and you look at Scrooge, and you know how we've already talked about that a while back, but how influential that's been culturally.
Oh yeah, if you mention the name Scrooge, then everybody will know.
Yeah.
And Chesterton was talking about how with Dickens's characters, you can talk to people on the street and people will recognize those names. If you call somebody a Scrooge, he said nobody else has really had that success except Conan Doyle with Sherlock Holmes. He says, but Conan Doyle only ever created one character that we remember, and that was Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
We don't remember, you know, whether Mrs. Hudson's hair was white or black. We don't remember anything except Sherlock Holmes.
But we've also in general, we've lost. Now we're influenced by visual media.
Yeah.
Right. And The Walking Dead and reality shows and the Kardashians and all those good things. So. Rather than themes and thoughts that Dickens was putting out. So.
But it can be just because it's a different medium doesn't necessarily mean that a genius can come along and take over that medium and be really popular. A lot of people have said that Breaking Bad is a way was one of those things. I haven't. The jury is still out for me on that one.
Well. But I would say this, look at Pride and Prejudice, you know, the A&E series, which I think has kind of got a life of its own.
Honestly,
influence.
Yeah, if I had to compare it, I would say Downton Abbey has a lot of the elements of kind of the way Dickens used to relate a story, but just in the way it's serialized, the way it's kind of sensationalistic.
Only it's not sordid, which isn't really a word, but I like to use it anyway.
Yes, sordid is somewhere between sordid and
torrid.
Torrid and torrid. Horrid, and it doesn't exist, but it's fun to say. But Downton Abbey is so very sordid.
It is sordid.
But that is something that people, and I think that's a fair comparison to make, because if I talk to people who love Downton Abbey, then I can talk to them about Lady Violet's life all day long, because she's like a Dickens character. She's somebody who's taken on a life of her own and it's has become kind of public, owned by the public. And
right.
So that's really fascinating to me. And just because something is popular doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. Dickens happened to be a genius who had a taste that was the same as the public's. And because he wrote,
let me think. What did you just say? Just because something's popular doesn't mean that it's bad. Is that what you just said?
Yes. Doesn't mean it's good either.
I'll have to think about that.
Well, I mean, that's what Chesterton was saying. People now tend to think that
I have a natural inclination against anything that's popular.
That's true. Me too. That's because we're snobs.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I mean, Chesterton, he says it actually in the book. He says, there's a thought among literary people that if something is popular, then it must be bad. And now we've taken it to the point to say that unless it is unpopular, it cannot be good.
That sounds a lot better to me.
He says, but look at Dickens, look at Shakespeare. People came out in droves to see Shakespeare plays because they knew what people liked. They knew what they wrote about life and death and comedy and tragedy. And in the book, Chesterton says, for instance, that there are two things which unite all men all over the world:
hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy is the cement,
glue that
the cement which glues us all together. Lady Jack Troutbeck says that. Well, it was two things. He said, the two things that hold all men together are comedy and tragedy. He says, because all men are ridiculous and all men are tragic. Every man is funny when he loses his hat, and every man is tragic when he loses his life, because there's something very humbled about a human being. There's something very ridiculous about a human being.
I am tragically funny.
You are tragically funny. I've seen tragic looks on people's faces when you were trying to be funny.
The man that shot at Liberty Valance.
The man that shot at Liberty Valance. Okay, we've been watching Westerns again. So, it was... Dickens' popularity, I think, stemmed from the fact that he really knew how to talk to people on their own level. And Chesterton says that the first step of not only being a Democrat in the old-fashioned sense, as he talks about it, is to take ordinary human beings, you know, people that you wouldn't normally think were all that much, but to make them interesting, to make the milkmaid interesting, to make your mechanic interesting, make your barber interesting. That's the sort of things that Dickens did.
I have an interesting barber. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Dickens took those people that you don't look at, people in the street, and he made them the most interesting person you'll ever know.
Mayberry did the same thing.
I think there's some truth to that. Possibly. Okay. I mean, Mayberry...
Floyd's an interesting barber.
Floyd is an interesting barber.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to what Chesterton was saying, though. It's just the way he took those characters and made something... He made the ordinary man immensely interesting.
Yeah.
You know, Arthur... What's his name? Dent. Dent Arthur Dent. In Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, he wasn't interesting because, what he had to be made interesting by sending him off to another galaxy, apparently. But yeah. Dickens would have had him sit inside his house all day and be absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
He took ordinary things.
Yeah, it was a gift to that.
And he made the romance of the middle classes. And I think that's something that's way important, especially as Christians, to look at, because God and ourselves, we look at ourselves and think that we're kind of at the center of our own hipster indie movie, and that it's really sympathetic to us. I'm talking Indy Wilson again, but that we all think we're interesting, but even if nobody else thinks we're interesting. Dickens reveals that we are all interesting, we just need to pay attention more. If you really started paying attention to that guy that sits in front of you in class and does funny things instead of being annoying by him, then you'll realize that he is, in fact, he's somebody that you could have been missing all your life. He's interesting.
That's true. Yeah.
Mr. Venus.
And that's a wonderful thing, by the way. Just as a real quick comment, is that we are way too quick to marginalize people. We pigeonhole them, we take one look at them, we think we know everything about them, whether they're, interesting or not, and wealthy or not, or smart or not, and it's just, that's a very bad thing to do. It's very bad, and I appreciate at least what Mr. Dickens may be trying to get across there, to appreciate everyone on their own merits. And give everyone a chance. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think he was very good at revealing life as an adventurous thing.
Except maybe politicians. And lawyers.
Well, he never did like lawyers very much.
There you go. Even more reason to like Mr. Dickens.
Oh, well, speaking of lawyers, we're kind of coming up on our time now, so let's talk about A Tale of Two Cities, which is my favorite Dickens book, because it's the first Dickens book that I really read. And it's kind of an exception from the other books, because it's very dark. It's a historical novel. He only ever wrote two historical novels. He wrote, I think it was Barnaby Rudge. That was a historical novel. It was set, I'm not sure when. But A Tale of Two Cities is set during the French Revolution. And...
You're not going to tell him how it ends.
I'm not going to tell him how it ends, naturally, because that would completely ruin it.
Yeah, good.
But it has the most remarkable ending in just about all of literature that I've ever read. Probably. I mean, to the point where when I read Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, it made me cry because it reminded me of A Tale of Two Cities. Which, I have a theory about that, though. I think that J.K. Rowling meant it to do that because she's a big Tale of Two Cities fan. Those of you who have read both books will know what I'm talking about. Anyway, it's actually the number one best-selling novel of all time.
Let that sink in. That's amazing.
Now, it's true. Now, it's not as a novel. Now, I don't mean like the Bible or anything, but it is the best-selling novel of all time. It's sold, I believe, over 200 million copies since it was published. And the second best-selling book of all time, coming in at a distant second, at 150 million copies, I believe, is The Lord of the Rings. I can't remember. Which is my favorite book of all time, and then A Tale of Two Cities is my second favorite book of all time. I don't remember the third book. I think the third book was like Mao's Red Book, because he published a bunch of different copies of that not because people particularly wanted to read it, but he wanted them to read it. And so book four, the fourth book in that was The Hobbit. I don't remember how many copies it sold, but that's a pretty good lineup. I don't remember the fifth book either, but I thought, man, you know. And Tolkien is another example of a genius who had the same taste as common people. Everybody loved The Lord of the Rings. Lots of people watch The Lord of the Rings and read The Lord of the Rings because they like battles and they like orcs and elves
and
hobbits.
They like a good story.
And they do like a good story. But there's so much depth there. There really is.
I mean, I'm reading, like, you know, in David Copperfield right now, I'm just very curious to see what he's getting into next, you know? I mean, It's just very engaging. It draws you in.
Yeah, it's an adventure. All of his books are adventurous. You're not quite sure what'll happen next.
That's where he's at now.
Yeah.
If you haven't read A Tale of Two Cities, you need to do that immediately.
Yeah.
And the first, you know, two thirds to three quarters of the book, you're going to be thinking, is this going anywhere? And what is this all about? But just stay with it. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. I'm going to cry right here in front of the national audience.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Okay. A lemon drop.
Yeah. Well, to kind of rush through the last half of Dickens's biography, about halfway through his career, he decided to write serious books, and he started doing that with Dombey and Son, and then David Copperfield. David Copperfield, I can't remember which one of those came in first, but it was really when he started becoming a much more serious novelist. And then he ended up with Bleak House, which is just enormous and dark, and it's all about money and plot, and much less about just characters stumbling around having adventures. And then he ended up writing Little Dorrit, and A Tale of Two Cities. Which he wrote in the process of leaving his wife, I think, at that point. And then he wrote Great Expectations, Our Mutual Friend, and The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which he left unfinished. So it's the best detective story of all time because nobody knows who did it, and they've been speculating ever since. But let's... No, what the heck. Let's talk about A Tale of Two Cities more. There's going to be a... movie version of A Tale of Two Cities coming out, and the Pilgrims podcast, well, it's actually, there has been a movie version, a script on the shelf for ages. Terry Gilliam was talking about doing it at one point with Mel Gibson, I think, something bizarre like that. Leonardo DiCaprio was talked about at one point, but that has never really, I mean, it's still just kind of floating out there. However, BBC4 has decided that they are making it, and that's a pretty solid thing. They're quite certain that they'll be doing that, I believe. They've got a script that is being written by a fellow named Alan Bleasdale, I believe, who has written the 1999 version of Oliver Twist, something along those lines. But that will be coming out. They haven't really started in on shooting or anything, but we figured that they probably needed some help with some casting decisions. And since we're sure they'll be listening to this podcast, we're gonna give them our casting decisions for our Dreamcast for our favorite novel. So, we're gonna start out with kind of some of the minor characters. And if you haven't read the book, then you probably won't be particularly interested in that. But who cares? Because we're gonna have some fun with this. All right, I want to talk. Well, let's start out with the villains. We'll talk about the Marquis Evremonde, who's the big, well, he's the second big baddie. He's somebody who kind of sits over in France and just sulks all the time. Who do we think should play him?
I don't know, Mr. Dance.
Yeah, I think Charles Dance would do well, because he was really good in Bleak House. He played Mr. Tulkinghorn in that, and he was really scary. And then there's Jerry Cruncher, who's
the heavy.
He's the comic character of the book. He's pretty funny. He's got a secret, and he has red dust on his fingers. And we're not sure why. Let's see, Jerry Cruncher. Well, who did you think should play Jerry Cruncher?
The feller from Horatio Hornblower.
Yeah.
Styles.
Styles. His name is Sean Gilder, I believe. I think he would do a pretty good job. He's getting up there now, though. I don't know.
Next getting up there. What do you mean getting up there?
the golden years.
Yeah.
You know, Jarvis Lorry, who was one of my favorite characters in the book, and I think it will be very difficult for anybody who plays that part to overcome Kenneth Moore's portrayal in the, like, the 1981 version, 1981, 1985, something like that. Because he was terrific. I loved him in that part. I can't. It's difficult to see anybody else. But you know, as a suggestion, maybe Anton Lesser, who plays Morse's boss in Endeavor. He also appeared in Little Dorrit as Mr. Myrtle.
He's too skinny.
Yeah. I think we've got Dr. Manette already, and he's kind of the frail one. So yeah. we need somebody. What about this guy, Bill Patterson from?
He might could do it.
He was Mr. Meagles in Little Dorrit, and I've. That's possible. He's kind of got that joviality about him, and
yeah.
All right. So Mrs. Pross, I think that's kind of a no-brainer. You get Imelda Staunton, who was in Nanny McPhee and Cranford, and she plays kind of, and she was in Harry Potter too. She played Dolores Umbridge. But she's just kind of the tough redhead that you see in all these different movies. Okay, Barsad. He's another villain. I think that the villain from Wives and Daughters, Ian Glenn.
I don't know. Yeah.
I think he's always pretty villainous.
I know who you're talking about.
No, speaking of more villains, the Defarges. And I was thinking
the French.
Yep. And I was thinking, Monsieur Defarge is there kind of just to play second fiddle to his wife, but he's kind of the big tough. He's the tough guy. He's the heavy, as you were saying. So I thought of Kieran Hines, who is kind of a chameleon. He's been in all sorts of different movies. He's played Mr. Rochester. He's played
Captain America. No, wait.
He didn't play Captain America. He played King Herod.
Always getting those two confused.
Me too. I mean, doesn't everybody?
He did the definitive Mr. Rochester.
That is open to debate. he was in Mrs. Pettigrew Lives for a Day. He was in Persuasion. That's what it was.
Yep.
As
a younger man.
Yeah. But Madame Defarge, who sits and knits trouble, you know. Well, my first choice for her would obviously be Tom Hardy, since he's played the role already. didn't anybody know that The Dark Knight Rises basically stole the whole plot of A Tale of Two Cities? Oh, well, you have learned something new today. Except that they left some things out, which would have made it a better movie. There are several characters in the movie, Stryver and Barsad, who are named after characters from A Tale of Two Cities. And Bane sits in the back knitting in one scene, which is cool. But I think I'm going to... Who is your choice for Madame Defarge?
Well, the sultry Miss... what's her name in Poirot?
Nick. Mademoiselle Nick.
Mademoiselle Nick from...
Peril
at End House.
Mm-hmm.
And her name is Polly Walker. And I think she has the right amount of coldness and, I think she could be like an icebox if she needed to be. And that's kind of what that role calls for, is someone that's just very ruthless in her goals.
Yeah, I think that would be pretty good. I was googling around and seeing what other people thought. Somebody had suggested Marion Cotillard or Cotillard, I guess, who's a French actress. You would have seen her in Inception, and she also played Talia al Ghul in The Dark Knight Rises. I think she'd be terrific. She's kind of got scary eyes. Okay, well now we're getting into the last few characters, and Mr. Stryver, who is Carton's bombastic companion. I think Philip Glenister is the only choice for that role. He's well known for playing Gene Hunt, he never plays characters that are very, very laid back. He's kind of a tough guy. I think he'd be terrific. Dr. Manette, we were talking about that. I think John Hurt would be terrific, but thank you to Gina D'Alfonso and Rachel McMillan for suggesting that. You got any ideas besides that one, or?
No, I think that would be. I think that would be a very good fit.
Okay, well, that brings us down to our finalists, and we spent a good bit of time talking over these. The first one we were going to do was Lucy Manette, who is one of the heroines, I guess the heroine. And your choice for the role initially was Carey Mulligan, who you can see in The Great Gatsby and various other things. And I think she'd be really good. But our second choice that you recommended was Felicity Jones, who was recently in The Theory of Everything. I think she'd be really good, too. So, but now, up to Darnay and Carton. Darnay... And this is my pick. These are my picks. That I think that it would be terrific if we got, for Darnay, Carl Urban, who played Éomer in The Lord of the Rings, and as Sidney Carton, Dominic Cooper, who played Howard Stark in Captain America and Agent Carter, and you can also see him as Willoughby in Sense and Sensibility, who's also British, by the way. I think that would be a terrific casting. That's kind of my dream casting.
And the important point about those two is?
They look a lot alike.
They need to look a lot alike.
They do. But they can't be the same actor, because...
No.
They did that with Chris Sarandon back in the 80s, and that was a disaster. I mean, first of all, because I kept on thinking, Humperdinck, Humperdinck! But it's...
Princess Buttercup.
Yeah. So I could never watch him in anything and take him seriously anymore. Though I guess, you know, if I was casting this movie for a miniseries instead of for a big Hollywood movie, those two are big Hollywood stars. So I would probably have to do like an alternate cast. I'd do like Tom Hiddleston and J.J. Field, who look a lot alike. That's a pretty popular casting thing on the other things. People have talked about Jim Caviezel too, but I don't think so. I mean, he's played Jesus' characters way too much already. Okay. Well, you got anything to add to that?
No. I think that, you know, we'll go ahead and send that over to our manager and have him, our people talk to their people.
Yeah. Oh, I think the fellow that played Enjolras in Les Mis, he might be a pretty good Sidney Carton as a second thing. But I've been thinking about that. But I can't think of anybody that looks like him, so So, you know, and the guy that plays Moriarty. Those are two of my choices, but I
from these guys?
Yeah, well, no, they don't look alike, but that's my problem. I'm trying to think of people that look like them. Anyway, as one bonus, the seamstress who appears near the end of the book, I think that Haley Steinfeld should play her.
Who's she?
From True Grit, Maddie Ross.
Oh yeah.
I think she could make an impression in a small amount of time.
Yeah.
So I think she'd be really good at that.
That's inspired.
Yes.
That's a slam dunk.
Yes. Okay. Well.
So have we come to the end of another Pilgrims podcast?
We have, and that went way better than I thought it would. I felt underprepared. Okay. We're going to talk about what we're going to do next week. Next week, which I have already decided because we haven't talked about it, we're going to be watching a movie called Sophie Scholl, The Final Days, and we're going to be talking about that and kind of some things connected to that and some of the movies we've seen recently, including a movie with Kenneth Branagh called Conspiracy. We're going to talk about some of that. We're going to talk about Nazis next week.
What should we talk about?
Which will be interesting, yes. By the way, it's a German film. It's got subtitles, but don't be daunted by that. It's a very good movie. You can find it on YouTube, I believe.
I guess that'll do. I mean, it's Easter, you know, talk about Nazis. Springtime, everyone's thoughts turns to Nazis.
I wanted to talk about as we're coming up on Lent, and we just talked about A Tale of Two Cities, in which a definite theme is the idea of resurrection. And I wish we had more time to talk about that, because I think Dickens kind of talked about that all throughout his work. I mentioned that he used the same verse from A Tale of Two Cities that he used in David Copperfield. He used the same verse in David Copperfield, which is, I am the resurrection and the life. Anyway, so that's kind of a little bit of an Easter theme for you there, but pretty much all of the choices, all of the things that I've been setting out for the next 4 or 5 weeks coming up towards Easter have to do somehow with resurrection or with martyrdom or with some sort of...
I think we should talk about words one week.
Okay. And... Do you just like to spring these things without context?
No. I mean...
Yes, you do. Okay.
I think we just need to talk about words. I think it'd be interesting.
Well, maybe we can talk a little bit about that next week. But I highly recommend you watch the movie. It's a really good movie. Okay, well, in the meantime, you can find us online at the Pilgrims Podcast blog, where you can find out about us from our biography pages. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter, at Pilgrims Podcast. You can email us and tell us your thoughts on this episode. Were we wrong? Do we need to be corrected? Are we completely right? You know, do you enjoy our podcast? Let us know at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. Leave us reviews on iTunes. We love it. All that stuff. All that jazz. So.
I think our guest next week is Brian Williams, right? He's coming over.
That's what he told me.
That's right.
one last thing. I say the dress is white and gold.
Well, are you looking at me?
The patriarch is colorblind, so he's been enjoying the last few days with this dress, because now everybody else knows how he feels.
Yeah, that's what it's like.
I looked at it and it was white and gold 1 minute, and then it was blue and black the next. It's the most uncanny thing ever. I've seen it both ways. Anyway, we better wrap this up. Okay.
All right. God bless us, everyone.
Now we've already used that as an exit line.
Oh. Well, I don't know any other exit lines.
We'll end on a note from one of my favorite quotes, you know, with no context, because I think it's great. You can be Silas Wegg and I'll be Mr. Venus. Mr. Wegg, if you was brought here loose in a bag to be articulated, I could name your smallest bones blindfold and sort them all in a manner that would surprise and charm you.
Now that ain't a state to be brought low about.